Thank you. Good evening, and it's nice to see so many people here tonight for the start of our 26th season. Our next program, I'll talk about our next program and then introduce the person who's going to introduce our speaker. Our next program in October, every year we try to have a journalist, and this year we have a particularly interesting journalist named Nigel Dwara. And Nigel came to my attention last year. He wrote a piece in the Oregon Humanities Magazine. He had been to Ferguson, Missouri during all of that violence. And he was there for the Associated Press. And he is now working for the Los Angeles Times. His beat is called The Border. And it's not exactly what you and I might think is The Border, but I'll let him explain that at the time. But his topic is when the media become the story, which is what Ferguson happened to be, of course. And so I hope you will return for that. It's a great pleasure tonight to have Mike Morrissey here to introduce our speaker. Mike, for years, was the director of the Seafood Lab right next door. And Mike's professor of food science at Oregon State University and is the executive director of the Food Innovation Center in Portland. And so Mike knows a whole lot about food and nutrition and everything we're going to talk about tonight. Thanks so much for being here, Mike.
Thanks, Steve, and it's great to be back here. And wonderful meal that Chris presented tonight, too, using a lot of local products. So a hand to Chris. As Steve mentioned, I've been with Oregon State University now for 25 years, and the last 7 years as director of the Food Innovation Center, and there's really a lot of exciting things happening around food. And in Oregon, in many ways, has really become a food hub. And just last night, I was fortunate to be invited to give one of the OMSI science lectures at Science at the Pub, which is a great place to give a lecture. It was on food entrepreneurship. And again, there's a whole wave of new people, you know, entering new products into the marketplace, you know, for a whole variety of reasons, and it's really an exciting time. Just this week in Portland, we have the program called Feast, which is Bon Appetit magazine calls it one of the 10 most important food festivals in the United States, with chefs coming in from all over Europe and throughout the United States, again partaking in Oregon's bounty. At the end of September, a very exciting program, again run out of Oregon State University, called the Culinary Breeders Program. And it's where geneticists and horticulturalists and food scientists get together with seed growers, chefs, producers, and restaurateurs to really look at what types of products should be out there in the farm. Instead of that, you know, tomato savor that would last several months, you really have a tomato that actually tastes good. You have beets that have a very colorful, very flavorful, all done through, you know, traditional, you know, breeding programs. And getting chefs and scientists together in a room really cause a great deal of excitement and a great future as well. It's a pleasure tonight to have two young farmers with us and to talk about their experiences. Teresa and Packy came up to the North Coast around 2003 and had a friend that, as I understand it, talking to them, had a dairy farm and was able to kind of use some of their plots of land to kind of try out their farming. They were able to purchase their first land and their first farm in 2009, called the 46 North Farm. And Teresa was one of the founders of, in 2010, of the North Coast Food Web. It's an organization dedicated to building a very strong regional community food system on the North Oregon coast. She was president of that organization from 2010 to 2013 and remained on the staff through this year. Then 46 North Farm was one of the founding vendors of the River People Farmers Markets in Astoria in 2011. And it's also a project of the North Coast's food web, and her farm sells produce, cut flowers, plant starts, and many other things through the farmers markets, and also provides a small-scale community-supported agriculture, which is growing, throughout the United States in terms of, again, I know Patty and I, we belong to a CSA out of Sauvie Island in Portland. It's just wonderful seeing all the different vegetables I had never seen. I mean, I grew up in an Irish Catholic family in Massachusetts, and the potatoes couldn't touch the peas, and you had and some of these things that are coming out of the farms that we're getting to experiment with is just really fantastic. And so there's a lot of excitement about farming, a lot of young people are getting back into farming. Steve and I were commenting on just in many of the West Coast land-grant universities, the largest, most rapidly growing colleges are actually in the College of Agricultural Sciences, because there's a tremendous interest in farming and natural resources, such as fishing as well, I'd include in that. So a lot of people have a great interest in their food, where it comes from, how it can remain sustainable. So without any further ado, I'd like to have Teresa come up here and give a little bit of her experience being a Lower Columbia Pacific Region farmer and what she sees for the future as well.
Thank you so much. You make me sound so much cooler than I really am. Thanks, everybody. It's really exciting to be here, and it's really exciting to get to talk to you about local food, which is something that is so dear to my heart and probably would really stun my parents. I think does still stun my dad. My mom passed away a number of years ago, but I don't think they would have ever thought in a million years that I would end up being a farmer. And for some reason, this bug caught me, and it will not let go. Sorry, Packy. We've been, as Mike said, we've been farming on the North Oregon coast since 2003. We started out on some leased land down in Seaside, and we were there for about 5 or 6 years, and then had the opportunity to purchase land out in Olney. 46 North Farm is about 9 miles east of here on Highway 202. We farm, the property is about 18 acres. We have, I think, about 2 acres fenced with another maybe acre planned to fence. We have elk and deer, very voracious deer. And we grow a mix of produce, cut flowers, and plant starts. And we have a small flock of chickens that for eggs, but we don't really have too many extras. Sometimes they end up in the CSA boxes, which is pretty exciting. We sell through farmers markets. I think we've sold, over the course of our time here, we've sold at almost every farmers market on the North Coast. We sold at the Astoria Sunday Market, the Tillamook Farmers Market. We were founding vendors at the Cannon Beach Farmers Market, the Manzanita Farmers Market, the River People Farmers Market. Haven't sold in Seaside. That's on a bad day for me now. And then the Lower Columbia Pacific Farmers Market in Long Beach as well. And it's really exciting to see all this happening out here. So we've really watched agriculture evolve and change just in the decade or so that we've been here. And I'm really excited about the future. In spite of some of the challenges. So one of the first things that someone said to me when we moved here and to start a farm, honestly, one of the first things someone said to me is, you can't farm in Clatsop County. Nobody farms here. And, you know, we were new in town, and I didn't have any experience farming, really. I'm very self-taught. And so But it seemed like you could grow things here. And I looked around, and it was a rural community, and there were cows, and there was agricultural land, clearly. And I was looking at people's gardens, and it seemed like a lot of things grew here. But on a certain level, they were right. There weren't a whole lot of farms. There weren't a whole lot of farms like what I was thinking about starting. Mixed produce, cut flowers, selling through farmers markets. There weren't even a lot of farmers markets. There weren't really any farmers markets. Most of the markets out here were largely arts and crafts markets that had a little bit of farm stuck in here and there. And a lot of the farms, to be honest, were coming from the valley out here. So it intrigued me because it didn't really make sense. And I think it's one of those situations where, you know, if you don't know that you're not supposed to be able to do something, you just kind of go ahead and do it, and you figure it out along the way. And you know what? It's possible. It's absolutely possible. You can farm here. It is challenging. but you can farm here. And what I found out along the way is that our region has been producing local food long before local food was local food. There has been food grown here. I mean, this has been an abundant region for food long before Europeans ever settled here. I mean, there was a reason why there were vibrant Native American populations here in the lower Columbia Pacific region. There is abundant seafood and game and berries and roots and tubers. And it's a very favorable climate, in spite of all the rain, for growing a lot of things. And a lot of the Europeans who came here and brought their farming practices with them from whatever country they emigrated from found that to be true. And certainly in the, you know, the earlier part of the last century, through the 20s, 30s, and 40s, farming was not crazy out here at all. And this was largely because there was a booming population out here that needed to eat food. And this was before, you know, long-haul trucking and big refrigeration and mega supermarkets. And so if people were going to eat food here, they had to produce it here. And so all along the, you know, the Nakanakam River, the Clatsop Plains, you had lots of truck farms that were growing peas and carrots and potatoes and lettuce and strawberries and cows and sheep and pigs and chickens. And there was a lot of food being produced here for the local community. It was a lot of local food. We just didn't think of it. People back then just didn't think of it as trendy or hip or anything like that. It was just what was for dinner. I love this photograph. This is my friend Ernestine Neitzel. She's the tall girl in the back. Ernestine still lives on what's left of her family's farm along the Nakanakam River. She's in her mid-90s now. And she grew up, their family farmed about 10 acres. It was kind of a classic truck farm. They grew peas and cabbage and potatoes and carrots and, you know, had a roadside stand. And they sold to visitors that were coming out Highway 26 in their old cars to come to the beach to vacation and to be out here, which was a thing that you did back in the 20s and 30s, much like it is now. And I thought about that because I was looking at this photograph of my farm stand this summer at the River People Farmers Market with my crew of people that have been helping me out. And we set up our farm stand downtown Astoria and sell produce to the visitors and locals that come through town, some of them from Portland, driving to vacation, and some locals that live here and need to buy food for themselves. So not much has changed, but also everything has changed. There's a lot of food that you can grow here. And this is what's interesting to me, because what I've learned as we've been farming here is that the barriers to growing food here, the barriers to agriculture here, are not technical. It's not that you can't physically grow these things. You can, absolutely. It's just that we don't. And why we don't, why there aren't more small farms here, why there isn't a vibrant agricultural community here in the North Oregon coast in the lower Columbia Pacific region, I think is kind of telling. And it talks a lot about some of the attitudes that we as a culture, as a country, have evolved over the last decades in thinking about where our food comes from and who produces it. And I think it also shows us that there's some promise. There's some shifts that are happening in how people think about food and where they want their food to come from, how they want that food to be produced. So one thing that's interesting, and I think this illustrates for me how these attitudes are shifting. When I meet someone for the first time, and you know, inevitably it's sort of like, hey, well, what do you do for a living? And I say, I'm a farmer. There's three basic responses that I get, you know, kind of summed up in three basic responses. And I think that they really illustrate this shifting attitude. Attitude number one, that's a whole hell of a lot of hard work. Well, yeah, it is. Farming is hard work, and I don't think that anyone will deny that, certainly not me. It is the hardest that I have ever worked in my life. I had no idea how much hard work farming is. It's physical, and the physical hard work is certainly challenging. I will say I am in better shape than I have ever been in my life from farming. There's some aches and pains, and I certainly wish I had my 20-year-old back and my 20-year-old knees. But still, it keeps you moving, it keeps you outdoors. I have an awesome tan. It's weird, but it's there. it's patchy. So it is a lot of hard work, but it's also amazing and challenging because it's not just physically hard work, it's mentally hard work. When you are a small farmer and you're the sole proprietor, it's not just that you need to be able to dig and hoe and plow. You need to be a soil scientist. You need to be able to read a soil test and understand how much lime to add, how much minerals, do you need nitrogen, do you have too much or too little? You have to be able to understand when you add compost and when not, when it's safe to till, is the soil too wet, is it too dry, when do you irrigate? You have to understand your pests. You have to be an entomologist and recognize, is this a good bug, is this a bad bug? What eats it, what not? Do I treat it? What part of its life cycle is it in? Is this gonna be a problem if I let it go, or can I walk away and maybe hope that something else will eat it? You have to understand the life cycles of plants, and you have to understand succession planting if you wanna have something to harvest all summer long. Some crops can go from seed to harvest in less than a month. So if you plant all your radishes at once and you harvest them a month later, you got nothing else to sell. So you've got to time it, and it's like a spreadsheet, and you're moving from bed to bed and crop to crop and planting here and there, and one crop comes out and another one goes in. And sometimes there's gaps, and sometimes terrible things happen, and oh my goodness, what are you gonna do? Oh, CSA box, you're not getting any lettuce this week. But hey, here's some carrots for you, and hopefully that'll be okay. You know, it's kind of a juggling act. So you gotta be able to do that. And in this day and age, if you're the sole proprietor, you've also gotta be your own marketing department. You've gotta understand how to set up your website and answer email and run a Facebook page and do all kinds of things and connect with customers and go to a farmer's market if you're gonna do that. If you're not gonna do a farmer's market, you've gotta be able to sell to a restaurant or sell to a retailer, and how are you gonna find those people? And do all that bookkeeping, invoicing, and keeping your business afloat. And then you've gotta get up in the morning and do it all again. Now, that's kind of exhausting, and it is hard work, but it's satisfying and it's exciting. And I will say this, there's a lot of jobs that are hard work out there. I think about the people that are fighting fires in Eastern Oregon and Northern California. That is really hard work. I have a friend who's a hospice nurse. That's hard work. I have another friend who's just starting teaching seventh graders. Standing up in front of a room full of 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, and trying to convince them that history and math and grammar is actually something that they want to know, that is hard work. There's a lot of jobs that are hard, and isn't it awesome that there are people who are willing to do those jobs, all different jobs? So that's number one. Number two, you're sure never gonna get rich doing that. Well, now, you know, that's probably true too, but that assumes that my goal is to get rich. And that's something that's interesting, I think, about our culture, that we really idealize wealth. We think that being wealthy ultimately is the goal, having more money than you know what to do with, having two or three houses and a couple of cars and fabulous clothing and lots of bling everywhere. And I kind of don't want that. I don't know if that makes me un-American or not. I'm kind of cool with that, because I just want the one house. It would be awesome if the farm was paid off. I just kind of want that. And my needs are pretty simple. I clearly don't need to dress fancy. And I just want to run a successful business. I want to make ends meet. And there are farmers all over the state of Oregon, all over the country, all over the world right now that are demonstrating that small scale direct market farmers can make it work, can be economically viable, can be successful. And I think it demands some economies, it demands efficiency, it demands good record keeping, it demands discipline, but you absolutely can make it work. As challenging as it is, we're also having one of our best seasons ever this year, and that's really exciting for us as a small business. Response number three, I think is kind of neat, because I'm hearing this more and more. When I go to our credit union to do our deposits, and maybe it's a new teller working with me, and she'll say, 46 North, what? What are you? And I say, well, I'm a farm. And they say, cool, where's your farm? What do you grow? Where do you sell it? And more, that's the response that I'm getting. People say, that's cool, that's amazing. You sell locally, that's really neat. I'm excited about that. I'm excited about hearing that. And I think that that illustrates the shift that we're beginning to see in our culture towards food and farms and local farms. As local food becomes more common in our communities, as farmers markets pop up, as you see more local food on menus of the restaurants you go out and eat at, local food is not something that's crazy. It's not a bunch of crazy hippies off, doing whatever. This is viable, practical businesses feeding people in their communities. And it is pretty exciting. So there are some realities, though, here on the coast. And I feel like I want to get these out of the way, because as much as I talk about the future and the excitement and all of this, here in the Lower Columbia Pacific region, our numbers are dropping. The 2012 agricultural census shows that in all of our counties that serve this region, the number of farms is decreasing. And the age of your coastal farmers is pretty high. So that definitely says that, you know, there's some things to be concerned about. There's some challenges. As you get older, this kind of work physically does get harder. It's not impossible, but it does get more challenging. But we really do need to get more young people starting farms, starting farming. And the cool thing, the amazing thing, the exciting thing is that there are so many young people who want to get into farming. And these are not crazy idealists. They're not even as naive as I was when I started farming, thinking, oh, I'll just move to the coast and start a farm. These are people that are going to these land-grant universities and getting educated and getting training. They're going through all kinds of apprenticeship programs and really learning from the ground up how to run a successful business. And there is so much education and support out there for them so that when they finally hit the ground on their own farm, they really know what's going on, and they are not going to have the kind of learning curve that we had. I honestly think that one of the big sources of this attitude that you can't farm in our region is this document. And this is interesting because when I was giving a talk earlier this year, I was looking for some information about farming in Clatsop County and agricultural statistics. And, you know, like all counties in Oregon, Clatsop County has goals. We have these land use planning goals. Dirk knows all about these, I'm sure. And they deal with different elements of the things that land is used for. And goal three is about agriculture. And here in Clatsop County, goal three, this is our plan. And I was looking at it, and I was looking at this page, and I wonder if you can notice the thing that's really interesting about this. It was written in 1980. 1980. I was 14. And okay, you don't have to do the math. It means that I'm 49. But 1980, this is the vision for agriculture for our county. Think about what was going on in 1980. Where was the world at? Where was agriculture at in 1980? What was happening? This is the opening sentence of our Clatsop County Comprehensive Plan Goal 3 for Agriculture. I gotta tell you, this is not a happy read. It kind of keeps going from there. That's sort of the high point, and then it just kind of descends into terribleness. And it's sort of basically saying, don't do it. And I'm really glad that I did not read this document before I started farming in Clatsop County, because I would never have started, because I would have thought, well, you can't farm here because look, clearly this is not something that you can do here on the coast. And yet, oddly enough, here I am 10 years later farming. I love this one. You'll love this one, Dirk. Farm expenses on the rise due to fencing needed to protect crops from elk damage. Total losses due to elk on farmland have not been documented but are well known in farming communities. For example, the annual Brown's Mead corn feed was canceled in 1979 because the farmer lost his entire crop to elk. Now that is tragic. That really is, but here's the thing. We can build fences. We have the technology. And you know what? They work. We built that fence in 2010, and the elk have never been inside it. Occasionally, a marauding deer, and it provides endless entertainment to our neighbors driving past on Highway 202 to watch Packy and I running around inside our enclosure, sometimes in our pajamas, chasing the deer out. Anyway, so has anything changed since 1980? I was thinking about the first community-supported agricultural program in the United States started in 1986. 1986, 6 years after that. The Oregon Farmers Market Association didn't start until 1997. I believe the Portland Farmers Markets didn't start until the mid-1990s. In 1980, there were no farmers markets on the Oregon coast. The USDA National Organic Practice Standards weren't even finalized until 2002. And look at the growth in farmers markets in the United States. In 1994, 1,755. In 2014, 8,268. In Oregon alone, over 160 farmers markets. There are so many community-supported agriculture programs all over the country now. And for those of you that don't know, community-supported agriculture are these programs where consumers invest in a farm up front. You buy into the farm, you make a payment, usually in the winter, and you pay in advance for a weekly box of vegetables that are going to come during the harvest season. I have some of our CSA members right here in the room. Hi, Dr. Birrell. Thanks. Did you like that cantaloupe? Did you eat it? It was super ripe, but it was good. Yeah, I know. So there are so many different ways for farmers here on the coast to sell, ways to access markets, resources that are out there that didn't exist in 1980 at all. I have to tell you, I mean, think about it too. In 1980, there were no personal computers. There was no internet. Seriously, that's a huge change. In 1980, if you were a farmer and you had a crop in the ground out here in Clatsop County, and maybe you thought somewhere there might be a chef that wanted to buy it, how would you know? How would you find them? You'd have to get on the phone and have a phone book and hope that you could get a phone book for Portland because, you know, maybe no one out here on the coast wanted to buy your crop of lettuce. And you'd have to do all this phone calling, and then your crop is getting older, and maybe you find someone, but you've got to harvest it, and you've got to drive it, and who knows what kind of price you're going to get. For me right now, I have this in my pocket. I carry around a computer with me every day. And I have, just this past week, stood over my crop of lettuce looking at a text from Andy, the chef at Street 14 Coffee, saying, hey, have you got 5 pounds of lettuce greens? And I look at my row and I think, and I can send him a text back saying, you know, I think I could actually pull 8 off of this. Do you want it? And he sends me a text back and he says, yeah, bring it in. And I harvest it, and that crop is already sold before I drive to town. And that's all because of this. In 1980, farmers didn't have a computer in their pocket. They couldn't take a photo of that lettuce crop and post it online onto their Facebook page and say, hey, we're bringing salad greens to Street 14. Y'all should go and have a salad there today. And Street 14 couldn't share it onto their page and say, hey, you should come in and have a salad from 46 North Farms salad greens. It's going to be delicious. And one of our followers wouldn't say, oh my God, I think I want to go have a salad at Street 14 because those greens are going to be really fresh. They just came out of the ground this morning. How cool is that? We're cross-marketing. We're small businesses supporting one another. And that's all because of technology that has evolved since 1980. And that is really cool. And that means that there are more opportunities than ever for small farmers out here to make a living. Farmers are innovative. There are farm stands, farmers markets, Skamakaway Farmstead Creamery, I love these people. I don't know if you have eaten any of their cheese. They are amazing. They're just 2 years old, these ladies over in Skamakaway running a goat cheese dairy. And they are kicking it. And they have a farm store there at the farm. Certain times of year, you can go and pet the goats, pet the baby goats, and sample their cheese and buy cheese. They're selling to Portland. They're at farmers markets everywhere. They're amazing. There's a lot of ways now for farmers to make it out here, and it's really cool and exciting to see what's happening and see the opportunities. And I think people are thinking about next generation. They're thinking about kids. They want to connect kids with where food comes from because they know that kids need to eat healthier. One thing that we've seen, it's interesting, you know, I don't mean to diss industrial agriculture, although I probably am about to, but there was a lot of change that happened in how we eat in the last few decades. As farms became bigger and food became more processed and it came from further and further distances. And we got further and further away from just pulling a carrot out of the ground and eating it. And our kids became very disconnected from where their food comes from and what fresh food tastes like. And although there has been a lot of streamlining of processes and food has become ridiculously inexpensive, and we now have food that can sit on a shelf for months at a time and not go bad. And we can feed an awful lot of people, and all of those things are true. We also still have phenomenal health problems in our culture today. It hasn't made us healthier. And we also still have phenomenal amounts of hunger in our communities. So it isn't necessarily feeding the world or even feeding our communities. So I think connecting the next generations to local food, whether it's in their home gardens, at the farmer's market, or my friend Martha, who brings her son Newt out to work on the farm and just straps him on and starts working. Exposing kids to where food comes from is great because it's building a new generation of eaters. And what's cool is that some of those kids are going to grow up to be farmers, and some of them are going to grow up to be eaters. Well, all of them are going to be eaters, but some of them are just going to be consumers, and that's what farmers need. This is so cool because there are now farmers markets all along the north, the South Washington, North Oregon coast, I think every day of the week except Mondays. So if you want to start a farmers market somewhere, you're probably going to have to go for Monday. I'm sorry. And the thing is, with a lot of these farmers markets, they don't have enough vendors. There are not enough farms. They're scrambling for farms. They want more farms because there are not enough people out here yet farming to fill all the spots at these markets. So there is a gap in the market. We need more farms. We need more people producing food, more people processing food, more people making jams and jellies and salsas and baked goods, selling at farmers markets, food entrepreneurship. That's what we need. Local food makes dollars and cents. I love this expression. And I think what's really cool about it, one thing that a lot of small farms get really slammed for is like, well, your food is so expensive and poor people can't afford it. And that's terrible. It's elite. It's just for wealthy people. And I really challenge that assumption. I have to tell you, I just took a walk through the produce department of one of our local supermarkets out here. I won't name names. And did a little price comparison shopping for myself just to see, is that true? And to be honest, I'm pretty competitive. I'm thinking I need to raise my prices. Oh my goodness. I mean, it's clearly there's a few things where, yes, it is way cheaper. And if that's the thing that you're concerned about, that your food be cheap, and that's the first thing you look for, then okay, there's no way that I can compete with that. But if you care about flavor, if you care about longevity, because my food will have just been pulled out of the ground at the very latest the day before, if not the morning of the market that you're buying it. If you care about how it's grown, if you care about my farming practices, and you want to know that I'm not spraying all kinds of toxic chemicals all over my produce, or you want to know that I'm taking care of my wildlife or stewarding my land or caring about soil conservation or water conservation, you can ask me. You can come up to the farmer's market and ask me how I grew everything at that farm stand, and I can tell you, and I will tell you, because I don't have a problem with that. And that's what's exciting. And what's really cool, too, is that more and more farmer's markets are finding ways to make food accessible for low-income people. And this is not just in Oregon, although Oregon is at the forefront of this, and I am really proud of that. But nationally, farmer's markets are more and more accepting SNAP benefits. And SNAP, for those of you that don't know, stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is formerly food stamps. And how it works at farmers markets is you bring your SNAP card to the farmers market, usually bring it to the information booth, and they run your card. And you get a certain number of, most markets do it this way, you get a number of tokens, little wooden tokens. They're usually worth a dollar each. And you can spend them with the farmers. And so I, as a farmer, will accept the wooden tokens. And then at the end of the market, I count them up and I turn them into the market. And then next week, they give me a check for however much those tokens were worth. It works great. The really cool thing that a lot of farmers markets are doing now is a match program. And that's where you run your card at the farmers market. And for example, here at the River People Farmers Market in Astoria, North Coast Food Web, which runs that market, they match dollar for dollar up to your first $10 each market. So when you run your SNAP card for $10, you actually get $20 to spend with local farmers. And for me as a farmer, that's incredible because that's $20 coming into your local food community, into our farm, into our bank account. And those are federal USDA dollars. That's the only federal subsidy my farm's probably ever going to see. And I'm willing to take it because it's exciting. And sometimes that's a significant portion of our deposit. And what's also really cool, there's programs, the WIC program, Women, Infant, Children program. They have coupons for Farm Direct where they're in these checks and people come and they spend them at the market and I just deposit it like a check. There's also senior nutrition coupons, the same thing for low-income seniors, that to help them access more fresh fruits and vegetables. And these, if you are eligible for these programs, please use them. And please go to the market and please spend them because this is money that you're bringing into our local economy and investing here in local agriculture. And that's really important. Food system is a terrible expression. It really is. Oops, what did I do? Packy. What did I do? I made, oh, there we go. Okay, whew. Sorry. So I think it's important to understand when people talk about community food systems, regional food systems, a food system is just the way that all of this stuff happens. There's production, processing, distribution, consumption, and waste. And a sustainable food system is one where these things are happening in a way that are not using a lot of external inputs, where not a lot of waste is being generated, where it works within a local region. And that's what a lot of us are really trying to make happen more out here in our communities, so that we are less dependent upon somewhere else. And I know that we can get food from somewhere else, and we do get food from somewhere else, and a lot of our food out here on the coast comes from somewhere else. And that's really what's happened in the last few decades, since the 20s and 30s, when agriculture started to decline, when it was possible to refrigerate food, when it was possible to truck it long distances, when it was possible to grow it on huge farms down in California or Mexico and bring it up here. That was the start of our food system moving away from being local and being much more national or regional or international. Because a lot of our food comes from other parts of the world now, China, South America, Central America. But what happens when something happens to somewhere else? What about if somewhere else has a historic drought? Or somewhere else has epic wildfires? Or somewhere else has political unrest and upheaval? Or what if somewhere else is so far away that skyrocketing transportation costs can mean getting food to you suddenly becomes really, really expensive? Or what if, do you remember December 2007, what if you have an epic storm blow through your little coastal community and so many trees fall down across the highways that somewhere else can't get to you because the roads are completely blocked? And that happened, and that was pretty amazing because our supermarkets out here keep maybe like a 2 to 3 day supply of food on hand. Not a lot of food. And by the time those chainsaws finally cut through those trees, food was running pretty thin out here. And that was a big wake-up call for a lot of people to think about, could we maybe produce a little bit more food here? Could we maybe keep it a little bit more local? Could we maybe be a little bit more resilient in our communities here? And the answer to that absolutely is yes, we can. There's challenges, obviously, but yes, we absolutely can. This is my local food system, one of my local food systems. And I had so much fun putting this together this afternoon because it was really interesting for me to think about within our local community, all these different connections and things. And I'm just gonna talk you through a few of them. So Fort George Brewery, most of you know them, they buy their grain from somewhere else because we can't grow grain here on the coast. So they spend money outside of the community and they bring grain in and they brew beer at the Fort George Brewery. And then that spent grain, the grain that is used, goes out to Brownsmead Island Farm, home of Dirk and Amanda Roan and all of their cows. And their cows love to eat that spent grain. I'm told that they're especially fond of the Cavatica grain. They like the dark, stout stuff. So, and Brownsmead Island Farm transforms that spent grain into milk that they sell to the Tillamook Creamery, and they also transform it into some pretty awesome manure. And that manure locally is known as Brownsmead Turbo Grow, although I am assured by people out in Brownsmead that it is also known as Durky Dew. And I gotta tell you, I kinda wanna revive that name because that's pretty awesome. So anyway, so the Brownsmead Turbo Grow comes to 46 North Farm. We pay Brownsmead Island Farm, and we also pay Ed Fisher. We purchase the manure from Dirk and Amanda, and it's delivered by Ed Fisher, a local man. And then we take that manure and we spread it all over our fields. And with that manure, we grow salad greens, all different kinds of crops, strawberries, lettuce. And we sell some of that to Street 14 Coffee. We sell some of that to the Astoria Co-op Grocery. Some of it goes to some individuals, Holly and Matt, Zach and Alex, who are members of our Community Supported Agriculture Program. Now, Alex works at Street 14, so she's paid by Street 14, who also pays us. And Zach works at Fort George Brewery, so they pay Zach. And Zach and Alex also shop at the Astoria Co-op Grocery, which sometimes sells stuff to Street 14 Coffee too. And then Holly and Matt, well, Matt works at the Astoria Co-op Grocery, and he also, I've seen him buy espresso at Street 14 Coffee, so I know they both go in there to buy coffee, and they are members of our CSA, so they're buying from us as well. And I know that Holly, if she wasn't pregnant, would be drinking at the Fort George Brewery, and probably once she has her baby, Matt's going to take her there and buy her a beer. And I also have seen Dirk and Amanda have dinner and drink a beer at the Fort George Brewery too, so some of that money is going back to the Fort George Brewery. And I will say this, even though my husband Packy does work at the Fort George Brewery, we also sometimes go and have dinner there and drink beer there too. And so a lot of money is going back and forth and all over the place. Now Holly works for a company, she's actually works for an organic certification company, and she's paid from somewhere else. So she's bringing money into the community from somewhere else and spending it in all these places. Good on Holly. The Fort George Brewery also sells beer elsewhere, and so they're also bringing money from outside into the community and then pushing it into this whole system as well. And this is kind of how local food systems and small businesses work. And so all of that money keeps circulating amongst all of us and keeps generating all of these different small businesses and individuals and providing livelihood back and forth. And that's pretty cool. That's some really great economic investment for purchasing some grain from somewhere else and someone getting a paycheck from somewhere else. I think that's pretty neat. And this is happening all over the North Oregon coast and the Southern Washington coast, all over the Lower Columbia Pacific, because this is just dealing with my farm and Dirk and Amanda's farms. And there are so many other farms for whom they are the hub of networks like this. And I think that this has the potential to continue to grow in our region. And this is wonderful. I want to see more of this. What's really cool is that there are very smart organizations like EcoTrust, like the Oregon State University Center for Small Farms, that are doing studies on local food systems and on some of the gaps that exist and how do we fill those gaps and how do we help local regional food systems become more sustainable. If you're interested in this stuff, I really recommend you reading this this study that EcoTrust just put out with assistance from Oregon State University Small Farms Program, the Oregon Food Infrastructure Gap Analysis, which of course is a very boring name, but it's a really interesting read and it does have some very cool infographics, so that makes it entertaining for people like me who like pictures. But it shows you pretty much this whole spectrum of what happens in the first mile from where food is grown, all the different ways that it's harvested, processed, packaged, slaughtered, cut, wrapped, washed, cooked, sorted, graded, and makes its way all the way over through all the different outlets to where it finishes its last mile and it's eaten. And all of those pieces along the way are part of this food infrastructure that people, very, very smart people, fortunately, are working on and trying to find ways to fill those gaps and trying to make all of these systems function better, because I think there's a recognition that local food systems and regional food systems really are a great way to go to build resilience and success and economic success in our communities. There are so many resources available to small farmers now that never existed in 1980, and many of these didn't even exist in 2003 when Packy and I started farming. The Rogue Farm Corps is an incredibly cool program that started down in Southern Oregon, and they've partnered with a community college down there to address the issue of internships on farms and providing affordable farm labor for small farms who often can't afford to pay high wages for farm workers who really want to train another generation of farmers. But the whole illegal farm internship thing was kind of sketchy, and a lot of people wanted to find a way to regularize this. So what they've done is facilitate an education program. They're partnering with a local community college. And so the interns are actually students of this agricultural college. They're a agricultural program. They're paired with farms that are the host farm. There's structure, there's training, there is education. The young people provide labor to the farms, and they get training, on-the-ground training, from the farms themselves. It's a really innovative program, and it's getting a lot of attention and slowly spreading up. I think there's now a rogue farm corps in the Portland metro area. And there's a lot of potential for this. And I hope to see this out on the coast at some point soon, because I think that this really has a lot of potential for some of our small farms out here. The National Young Farmers Coalition is doing a lot of advocacy on the national level for young farmers and dealing with a lot of the issues of small and beginning farmers. And I will say at the heart of this, people I love, the Oregon State University Small Farms Program, these people absolutely are my heroes. They are devoting so much time and energy to trying to find ways to make small farms work, to make them not just technically successful, but economically successful as well. And they're helping small farmers find ways and learn the skills that they need to be viable. They have, I'm excited about this because they've really identified the North Oregon coast as an area. So the Grow the Coast Conference, North Coast Food Web here in Clatsop County, and Food Roots in Tillamook County, these are two organizations that work a lot on community food systems. OSU Extension Service and the Oregon Small Farms Program provided tremendous support to help make this conference happen. These were conferences that were attended by hundreds of people, providing small-scale agriculture and growing workshops and classes to farmers out here on the North Coast. And what was really cool too, OSU Small Farms Program has this amazing training program that they've developed for small farmers. It's called Growing Farms, a Whole Farm Management Program. And they started it in 2007, and it was an in-person class. You had to go to the Willamette Valley to take it. Pretty much, I think it was being offered at their research station in Aurora. So it was pretty, it was prohibitive. It always happened in January, and classes always started at 8 in the morning. So, yeah, I know, but you know, when you live on the coast, and it's January, and you have to be at a class at 8 in the morning, that's kind of sketchy. It was really hard for me. I wanted to take it so bad. And what was cool is that this past January, they brought that program to the coast. And we were a test case for a new way that they're teaching that program, where they basically put the entire program online. They spent a lot of time and effort and resources making it an online program with worksheets and videos and all kinds of digital stuff. And we were sort of a hybrid class where some of the class you went through online and it was self-guided and you worked through things and you watched the videos and you got the training. And then we had several classes in person where Gary Stevenson, the director of the Small Farms Program, came out here and met with this cohort of 15 or 16 small farmers who were trying to figure out how to make it work out here and talked us through stuff and shared his wealth of knowledge and expertise. And it was amazing. It was transformative. It was so exciting and wonderful. And I really want to see them do that again. I want to see that investment continue to happen out here, because that kind of education and support is what we need to get our small farms off the ground in our region. The Extension Service out here is great. They're doing a great job. And there is so much potential for more training, for more classes, for more investment. Another really cool program, this Farm Hack. This came out of an organization on the East Coast called the Greenhorns, which is another young farmer organization. And FarmHack, they've partnered with technology universities like Caltech and MIT to help devise cool ways to manufacture small-scale farming implements that can be replicated from materials that you can source locally and inexpensively. And there is so much amazing innovation out there for, bicycle-powered potato washers and things like that. And I know that sounds kind of crazy, but when you're pretty small scale and you just need to wash, like 20 or 30 pounds of potatoes, that can be pretty cool. And you can, bodge it together with an old bike and some wooden slats, and it can be really cheap. And a lot of times it's stuff you can just find in a dumpster somewhere, and it's kind of cool. I mean, that's amazing. This is the other cool thing that's happened since 1980 and since the advent of the internet, is that I can sit in my small farm in Olney and go online and scroll through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of free plans on their website for how to build just about anything that we could ever possibly need to build for our farm. And it is amazing and inspiring and cool. And that is pretty recent, and that didn't exist for farmers back in 1980. Another thing that didn't really exist back then, I think they existed, but they weren't really widely used, were greenhouses. Well, greenhouses have existed, but these polytunnels, hoop houses, this is something that is really making a lot of farming and farming unusual crops that don't naturally grow well out here, like tomatoes, not just possible, but economically viable. We pull a lot of tomatoes out of our hoop house. And in the wintertime, you grow salad greens. You grow spinach and arugula and lettuce mix. There's ways that you can use these year-round. And the really cool thing for this one, this was partially funded through a grant from the NRCS. Well, not really a cost-share program from the NRCS. The National Resource Conservation Service has a national program where they've been helping farmers all over the country build hoop houses as season extenders on their farm. And they do a cost share where you agree on a price up front. This is what's going to cost to build this hoop house. And you build the hoop house, and they come out and inspect it and say, yes, indeed, you did build that hoop house to our specifications. And then they give you a check. And that's pretty cool. You do have to report it as income, and that's, you know, challenging sometimes. But still, it's awesome. And it got us a hoop house that we would not have been able to afford. And we've put it to very good use ever since. And again, these are innovations. These are things that are making farming in our region somehow not seem crazy and not seem unviable and not seem like the doom and gloom spiral that I read about in our land use goal 3. This is another thing, another area that I really think the coast should be looking at: agritourism. We hear a lot about how we are a visitor community now. This is where our economy is going. It's all about visitors. Well, agritourism has been happening for decades all around the world. People travel to Italy to go and visit farms and take a cooking class. They travel to France. They travel to Thailand. They travel all over the world. Culinary excursions are on the rise. People love to visit places where there is food happening, and they want to taste what's happening in that region. They want to know. They want to understand. They want to have these culinary experiences. And Oregon, the Oregon Visitors Bureau, Travel Oregon, the Oregon Tourist Board, they recognize this, and they are investing a lot of money and time and attention all over the state of Oregon in developing and promoting agritourism activities, events, experiences on small farms to try and draw tourists to our region. And it's working. I love the statistics. 6 out of 10, 56% of U.S. adults who visited Oregon during 2 years prior to the survey that happened in 2013 reported participating in a culinary experience while visiting Oregon. And a majority of Oregon visitors participating in a culinary experience made plans to experience that activity prior to departing from home for their Oregon leisure trip. Don't you love that language? That language is ridiculous. But what they're saying is that those people booked that cooking class before they ever left home. They knew they wanted to do that. They were coming to Oregon, and that's one of the things that they wanted to experience. And we started this on our farm this summer. We experimented with some cooking classes. They were really fun. They were small. But we did a thing where people came out to the farm, and we did a farm tour. So we wandered around the farm, and I showed people how crops grow, what they look like, how you harvest them. We tasted some stuff out in the field. And then our friend Marco, who's a local chef, did a cooking demonstration for people and took the things that we'd harvested, much of it being processed right there in front of people. Some of it we did prepare in advance. And he talked them through how to do various dishes with fresh ingredients from our farm. And then we all sat down and we enjoyed a meal together. And then afterwards, we went on a further tour to the back greenhouse and looked at our tomatoes growing. These were delicious, amazing, wonderful meals, wonderful people coming out to experience the farm. The groups were small. It was great. We had a lot of personal attention, some great questions. We all learned things. And these were very minimally marketed. And we had a lot of response. And I think we're going to do it again. I think we're going to do it again next year, and we're going to market them better, and we're going to learn how to do this better. And there are more and more farms all up and down the Oregon coast that are starting to do this. Our friend Ginger down in Nehalem has just starting a business. For a long time, she's been running our Evolution Gardens out of Nehalem. And she and her husband and have just purchased property called, and they are calling it North Fork 53. It's a property right next to their farm. And they are doing a farm stay and education programs and beginning farmer training. And there's going to be a store on the farm and all kinds of cool stuff that they're doing down there. Skamakaway Farmstead Creamery. Farm tours, come out and meet their goats, taste their cheese. You can go on Friday afternoons up to Puget Island to Stockhouse Farm, where they host the Puget Island Farmers Market. And Rob Stockhouse is there grilling pizzas. They have music. They have farmers that come from their region. It's an awesome, it's a tiny, tiny island, Puget Island. There's not much going on there, but they have a vibrant farmers market. And people make plans to go to Puget Island to experience their farmers market and have a local wood-fired pizza with fresh local toppings from the farm on top of it and experience an afternoon out there in the middle of the Columbia River. And these are all experiences that people are coming to us for because they want to taste what we do out here. They want to taste our seafood. They want to taste our cranberries. They want to taste our razor clams. They want to taste our strawberries and blueberries and huckleberries. They want that experience. They want to connect. And I think that more and more, as we have moved farther and farther away from our rural roots as a community, I think that people long for that connection. They long for an understanding of where their food comes from. And I think as people understand more and more some of the compromises that we've made in embracing an industrial food system that doesn't always take compassion or care into account, because it can't, because it's got a pretty hard bottom line, I think people have concern. And they want to know more about where their food comes from. They want to know how the animals are raised. They want to know how they're treated. They want to know their farmer. They want to know where their food comes from. And those are great ways to connect. And the cool thing is that it connects people with healthy food. It connects people with the raw ingredients to prepare food for themselves. And you get more and more places like North Coast Food Web just starting teaching cooking classes in their new commercial kitchen in their new building right here in Astoria, teaching people how to cook, because these are skills that we've lost in generations. People don't know how to take raw ingredients and transform it into a meal. And those are skills that they want to learn. People are interested in that. They want to know this. And there are people out there who want to teach it and who want to learn. And I think that that is really amazing and wonderful and shows a lot of promise for our region. I think that we as a culture have been told way too much that you can have whatever you want, whenever you want it, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I find this very poignant philosophy from the 20th century to be really something that we all need to take to heart. You can't always get what you want. But if you try, sometimes you just might find you get what you need. And what we need is health. What we need is community. What we need are connections. What we need is local food. These are my customers. These are some of my customers. Some of my other customers are sitting right here in the room, and look, they're smiling too. People love local food. They love fresh flowers. They love fresh strawberries. They love farmers markets. When I sell to people at the farmers markets, most of the time they are smiling, and that's awesome. How many people's customers look like this all the time? It's pretty cool. Sometimes this is my office. And sometimes this is my commute. I am a lucky person. I won't say that farming is easy. Farming is hard, and it continues to be hard, and it continues to be challenging. And it will probably continue to be challenging the rest of my life, the rest of our lives. But I love it, and I'm committed to it, and I'm excited about the future here because I know that people care. I know that people want to see this happen in our community. There is more demand out there than I can meet. There are more restaurants that want to buy local food. There are more people that want to sign up for our CSA program. There are more farmers markets that need farmers. There are more people looking for local food than I can possibly hope to or want to actually try to grow. There need to be more farmers. there's opportunity here and it can happen. Thank you.